Geekscape.com.
Can the white race survive? Part 5. The Far East. In dealing with the Orient, especially as concerns China and Japan, we may meet with dissent expressed by those who regard the so-called Oriental Eye as an indication of a distinct race or branch of humanity. The very first inkling of the cause of diversity in colour and mentality of the human family occurred to me on the streets of San Francisco's Chinatown one day in March 1909. A friend was showing me through Chinatown when he stopped a distinguished-looking passerby and introduced me. We talked for a few minutes before I learned to my great surprise that the gentleman was a native of Peking, born of Manchu ancestry. I would never have picked him out as a Chinaman, which, of course, he was not, according to strict Chinese interpretation. He was dressed as an Occidental, was fair of complexion, had light brown eyes, of normal Western cut, soft black hair, and could easily have passed as a member of any dark European type. This casual meeting set me to thinking about and studying the race question more earnestly and on a different tack to my previous course. Many educated people think erroneously of the Orientals as being moon-eyed, without exception, and think that this peculiar fold of the eye does not exist among other parts of the Earth's dwellers. And even such a great scholar as Roland B. Dixon, in his prodigious work, Racial History of Man, explains the occurrence of the mongoloid type in distant parts of the earth as the result of immigration in past ages of peoples from the original Eastern Asiatic habitat. I have observed many cases of at least the Oriental eye among pure whites, perhaps never quite so much developed as among some of the southern Chinese. But the type is not at all uncommon among our mulattoes and all grades of mixture between whites and Negroes in the United States. One of my earliest observations was a Negro family in Louisiana of this type. The mother was a half-breed and possessed a moderately developed Oriental cut of eye. Her husband was a full-blooded black African with a normal horizontal eye line. But all of her 6 children, 1/4 whites, had more definitely Oriental eye lines, even with a distinct hint of the Chinese eye fold. This, and numerous similar cases that I have in more recent years observed, leads me to believe that this form of the eye is not the peculiar possession of a distinct Oriental race, but is a result of some strange work of natural law in racial cross-breeding. This belief is strengthened by the fact that practically the whole of the Negro population of the United States was of West African origin, without mixture of the mongoloid, or so-called mongoloid type, claimed by Dixon for Eastern and Southeastern Africa. As to the invariability of the Oriental eye among Orientals themselves, any traveller, not even having made a special study of the matter, if he has been through both northern and southern China and through Japan, will declare without hesitation that thousands of the natives, especially of the upper, fairer-skinned classes, are without this form of eye, while but a minority have it in pronounced form. Very early in the studies that became the foundations of these podcasts, the people of Asia occupied a large place. I found that the populations of none of the larger Asiatic lands are homogeneous in physical type, nor in complexion. To speak of the Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Siamese, or other Asiatic races is a misnomer. Buxton, and others to the contrary, notwithstanding. In all those countries, there is a wide variance between the elite at the top and the lowest coolie stratum, especially so in China, considered as a whole. It also is distinctly true in Japan. We shall treat more of this further on. It is impossible to obtain such rich stores of historical and archaeological records of ancient East Asiatic lands as we find waiting for us in almost every other case of quiescent or dead civilizations. But there is enough proof in what we do have, coupled with study of the contemporary peoples, to prove, beyond a doubt, that between 5,000 and 3,500 years ago, white peoples, classed by Dixon as Caspian and Alpine, entered China from the west and northwest, conquering and displacing the indigenous population. The latter, comparatively small in numbers, in the Yangtze Lower Valley and to the south, were gradually forced into the south. They were unquestionably Negroes, for the further south we go in China, we find the Negroid type becoming more and more distinct, running on into Indochina. Still further south, in the Malay Peninsula, there are remnants of the kinky-haired Negro, practically undiluted. And it is only a short way through the mountain passes, into the valleys of India, where the Negroid element is much heavier on the average. There is a considerable concord of agreement today between scientists and scholars who have given serious attention to the subject as to the influx of wave after wave of white peoples into China thousands of years ago. Perhaps a mean average of the differing opinions would place the first influx of white peoples from the West at about the middle of the 3rd millennium BC. These first migrants passed from somewhere in the general section of the Caspian through the modern Turkestan region and found their way down the valleys of the Yangtze or Huanghe rivers, mostly the former. Later, there were more white immigrations, or invasions, from the northwest, coming in by way of Mongolia. There is much data on which to base a belief that the Siberian inhabitants were white, or almost pure white, down to well within our era. Even as late as Genghis Khan, he and his followers were certainly of a fairer type than the present populations of his native region. B. L. Putnam Weil, in discussing the origin of the early builders of China, says, "While the school, which insisted on the migration theory, has been for some time almost discredited, the recent great and important discoveries of painted pottery almost identical with the prehistoric pottery of Western Asia, in strata belonging to the 3rd millennium BC, has revived the belief that a definite relationship between Sumerian and Chinese culture will finally be established, together with certain racial affinities." We have, of course, the seemingly valid argument of the philologists against kinship between the Chinese and the Western branches of the white peoples. The Far Eastern languages are said to be as different from the great body of Indo-European languages as the language of the Martians might be. But the case is not quite so strong if we take a broader perspective view. A young Chinese student of mine once called my attention to a number of ancient Chinese hieroglyphs which were strikingly similar to some old Egyptian forms with similar meanings. It is wholly possible for an ideographic system such as modern Chinese script to have evolved from such a system of pictorial hieroglyphs as used by the ancient Egyptians. We know, of course, that the earlier forms of Chinese script were near akin in form to the Egyptian picture writing. This could have been mere coincidence, but it is not stretching the imagination far to see a common origin, at least in the idea, if not in much of the earliest forms. There is such a striking resemblance in the general appearance of the ancient cuneiform writing of the Akkadians, those old ancient of ancients in civilization, when compared to Chinese writing, that a novice, innocent of any knowledge of the two, might easily confuse them. When one sees the resemblance, and remembers the other reasons for believing that the two peoples, builders of their respective homes in the two double valleys of the Euphrates Tigris and Yangtze Huanghe, originated in the same mother of peoples, Caspian Basin, it is not an entirely idle hypothesis to believe they are rooted in a common origin. Their later differences in development could easily be that of the vast separation in space and time. The linguistic kinship in spoken words and forms is not entirely lacking. The Chinese count in tens, as do all Western nations. They distinguish the right and left hands as we do. They bow and kneel in worship. The same consonantal beginnings of the words for mother and father are quite general. M is the initial of the word for mother in most languages, West and East, being Ma or Mu in Chinese, Tibetan, Ma, Sanskrit, Matar, Hebrew. M, also for father, we have Chinese, Pa and Fu, Tibetan, Paha, Korean, Abadi, Sanskrit and Hebrew, Av, Abba, etc. The thread of kinship in the spoken languages is admittedly very tenuous, but if we discover ever so slight kinship, we can easily see how such a great diversity should have come about. We in the United States have been separated geographically from our mother English for only a few generations. We have constantly been in touch with the mother country, receiving thousands of immigrants all the while. But most important of all, we have been using the same phonetically written language in the same grammars and the same pronouncing dictionaries to a great degree, and have had great numbers of English teachers in our schools and universities. Yet we have developed distinctions in language that are painfully evident to the Englishman when he first comes among us, and for Americans going for the first time to England. Now let us look at the Chinese, and in speaking of the Chinese, we speak for all the others related clearly to the Chinese in the Orient and Oceania, with perhaps the Americas added. The Chinese never had a phonetic alphabet with which to transmit and conserve the spoken sounds of their language. As a result, their spoken language has changed so rapidly that it often happens a native of one district travels 30 miles and still, being among his own countrymen, cannot converse with the natives of the district. If the local dialects have grown so diverse, why is it strange that the body of the spoken language, never held cohesive by a common system of written phonetics and grammars, should not change extremely from an ancient form in the course of thousands of years? And during that long period, beginning at the very first, the influence of the conquered and very likely enslaved Negro aborigines was their probably agglutinative speech was not negligible. In fact, absorption of the indigenous Negroes may yet be found to have given the Chinese language its stamp of distinction from Western languages. The flag of China, with its five colours, was emblematic of its five races, but among those races, Chinese, Manchus, Mongols, Tibetans, and Muslims, the aborigines were not included. It is definitely established that there was an aboriginal or autochthonous population in the region when the first ancestors of the civilization builders came. And as most of these aborigines were not enslaved and absorbed, as great numbers must have been, were gradually forced into the south, or at least the white elements did not advance to the south in great enough numbers during the earlier times to displace the blacks living there. We find today that the descendants of those aborigines are in most cases much darker and more platyrrhine than the fairer portions of the population. Especially is this so among the so-called black Mayo, the essential meaning of Mayo being autochthonous. They are called black not because they are still full black, but as they are much darker than regular Chinese, and as it is known that they have intermarried much with lighter strains of the Chinese, it is reasonable to believe they were black in ancient times. And this argument holds for the black Lolo, likewise descendants of the aborigines. According to Ting, the Chinese anthropologist quoted by Buxton, there are westerly Lolos reported by travellers to have tall stature, fair skin, and more regular features, which is significant in connection with Ting's claim that the Lolos have, by way of the Changs, received much blood of the ancient Iranians, a white Aryan people. Buxton says, in reference to the tribes of aborigines, it appears that here also we must link them up with the brown race. These aborigines and alien tribes are all that is left of the early inhabitants of China. He also says that although they have a culture which differs in many respects from that of the Chinese who surround them, they have intermarried so much with the Chinese that the original type has been practically swamped. In other words, the infiltration of white man's blood by way of the already mongrelized Chinese has lightened the skin of the original stock of blacks. It is not my intention to weary the listener with quotations of a maze of historical data which can be perused in nearly all recent histories of China, but I am assuming that it is generally admitted that the historical population of China came in thousands of years ago from the west and later from the north and the northwest. It is more than probable that the indigenous population, being of the Negro race, was simply a northern extension of the same savage type found by the Aryans inhabiting the lush regions of India and Indochina, where life for the savage was easy. It was natural that these savages should wander into the subtropical valleys of southern China and even reach the fertile lands further north, but they did not, of themselves, reach the colder northern regions, nor the sterile country of the west. To the far west of China, we know that in ancient times, contemporaneous with the earliest migrations from the west into China, there was a great breeding ground of white peoples. In spite of notable exceptions, among whom are Madison Grant and other Nordicists, there seems to be an avalanche of agreement that from somewhere in this general Caspian world part, the earth has received wave after wave of the hardy, pioneering white peoples. While some of these venturesome bands were traversing the upper eastern valleys from Aral Lake through Turkestan and into China, we know that others forged into the habitable lands of southern and central Siberia, finding livable conditions in the forests and grassy plains of Siberia further and further to the east, northward of the deserts in the south. They pushed on as they increased in numbers and were thus forced to expand. Buxton shows that the early inhabitants of Siberia were whites. In these cold northern regions, with their rigorous winters, these whites found no dark-skinned savages in those early times. Quite likely, these nomadic wandering whites, like their cousins who wandered in similar fashion into Europe, were poor groups from out of the home population in the original habitat of whites, and carried nothing but their material equipment of a crude sort and their immediate families. I believe it is the general conclusion of ethnologists that no human beings existed in Siberia anterior to the approximate period known as the Neolithic Age for Europe. We find then that after a very long time, these northern cousins of the white invaders of prehistoric China finally reached so far east in Siberia as to come into contact with the already established Chinese on their northern borders. These ancient Siberians were whites, as indicated, but when they first began to descend upon the borders of the civilization their kinsmen had established in the valleys of the Yangtze and Huanghe and farther north, they quite likely found a people who had already enslaved the Negro aborigines and perhaps had even begun the raids into the present Indochina and the Malay Islands to bring in more black slaves. With these slaves, miscegenation had progressed to an enervating extent. How else can we explain the monotonous repetition of victorious invasions of the northern nomads into civilized China? In reading the history of China, we find racial restocking of the country with white blood in striking similarity to ancient Egypt. But while in Egypt the infiltration of the Negroid element from the south was very slow, sometimes purposely checked, as against the stream of new white blood that came from the north by way of Suez and from the Mediterranean basin, in China there was from the start a large native Negroid element ready for assimilation, counterbalanced to a less comparative degree than in the case of Egypt by the periodic invasions of white strains from the north. When we study China, north and south, we find undeniable confirmation of this claim, the southerners being on average much more Negroid than the northerners.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.